call this meeting of the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness to order for Tuesday, April 7th, 2015. We're going to change the order just slightly, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3447 first. Mr. Administrator, would you enlighten us to what this bill does?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3447 appropriates money from the General Fund to the Department of Land Conservation and Development and directs the agency to develop guidelines, best practices, model plan provisions, and recommendations for building code provisions related to tsunami resilience.
Thank you. Representatives, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record. So you're on that side of the podium today, Representative Boone.
Deborah Boone, House District 32. And trying to be in two places at once today. So, and I will be brief because Representative Widener is really the daddy of this bill. And we're all on it. But we support this bill. And again, it's part of our resilience package. And it's something that we've all been working on now for up to 4 years, I think, now, total. And I will let him do the explaining and answer the questions. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I am State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, encompassing Yamhill County and part of Southwest Washington County, and up here separating the two troublemakers and one of the So, Chair Lively and distinguished members of the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 3447 today. My name is State Representative Jim Widener, and my district does encompass Yamhill County and Southwest Washington County. House Bill 3447 comes from the Oregon Resiliency Task Force, of which I was a member. The Oregon Resiliency Task Force was established by passage of Senate Bill 33 last session to address the catastrophic disaster and what the state can do to circumvent some of the disaster fallout and how to best prepare for their arrival of these disasters. At the conclusion of the task force, we were tasked to adopt legislative recommendations, of which this bill is one of those recommendations. House Bill 3447 will assist in the creation of tsunami plans for critical areas with special consideration for flood zones. We focused on the basic necessities needed directly after a disaster and worked with the Office of Emergency Management to identify these facilities. We want to assist local governments to provide tsunami-safe upgrades to local hospitals, emergency service buildings, cities, or town halls, as well as draft growth strategies after disaster strikes. The Land Conservation and Development Commission, in cooperation with the State Department of Geology, Mineral Industries, and the Department of Consumer Business Services, shall develop best practices and model a plan with recommendations for building code provisions to improve tsunami resiliency. Local flood inundation zones. Municipalities are tasked with identifying emergency services, buildings, and other essential community facilities and create strategies to facilitate relocation outside tsunami inundation zones. This bill will also provide financial assistance to these local governments for planning and the execution of the findings. We have discussed this with our fellow legislators, and Ways and Means Committee will provide an amount of assistance that is available in this budget. Thank you for your time and attention to hearing this bill today, and please consider scheduling a work session for our citizens in danger of tsunami. That are in danger of tsunamis and can become prepared for these devastating natural disasters that can occur. And I am open to any questions after Representative Leininger speaks.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee. I'm Representative Ann Leininger. I represent Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland in House District 38, but I see this as something that, as an Oregonian, it's really important to support. And so I've joined my good colleague as a co-sponsor of this bill, and I wanted to be here today and speak in support of it. We have a wide range of different risks that we need to deal with in order to keep community members safe, in order to minimize costs in the event of a disaster and maximize safety in the event of a disaster. And the Resiliency Task Force of which my colleague spoke, has done tremendous work coming up with a plan that community members can live with, that has broad support, that will enable coastal communities to plan for what to do in the event of a tsunami. It's completely consistent with some work that I've been working on with a bunch of people to do a rulemaking and provide some guidance under Goal 7, Natural Hazards of our statewide land use planning system. So these, which would deal with tsunami and flooding and erosion, landslides, and wildfire. But the bottom line is we've got to get going helping communities have guidance that they can use as they prepare to deal with these situations. This does exactly that. It was it's a product of a great process, and I'm honored to be supporting it here with Representative Widener.
Thank you. What questions do members have? Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, how exactly, I understand what DLCDC does. It's mostly rulemaking. There's no hands-on or anything of that nature. Tell me exactly how they fit into this. Give me an example.
The reason this came about, Representative Esquivel and Chair Lively, when we started working on it, and I believe Dave Stuckey will be coming up here afterwards and speaking on this bill as well, but one of the things we have because of LCDC is some of our urban growth boundaries are going the wrong direction. They're staying in the tsunami zones or the flood zones or floodplains rather than because we'll have, it could be a forest area. You look at a lot of our coastal districts, it's all forest land that comes down to us. Well, they can't actually develop or go into forest because of our planning. So this basically is telling LCDC that we need to start looking at going up rather than out and being in the flood zone or the tsunami zone and start looking at your urban growth boundaries and expanding them into forested areas.
Sure. So what we're saying is we want an exception to the 19 goals that we have because of future problems that we may experience. Plus, would it be like a conditional use? Is that what you're saying?
No, it would be expanding the urban growth boundary
zoning.
The zoning is what it's going to change when they're looking at expanding. So, and actually, that is
line three. So
19,
section.
Yeah, section three.
In
section 1, line 19. So, taking into consideration tsunami inundation zone maps produced by the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, the Commission shall adopt provision by goal or rule that require local governments in which their communities at substantial risk of experience severe impact from tsunami to, and then it's adopt the provisions to expand their urban growth boundaries out of natural disaster zone.
So then you hit on the key. Local governments get to do this instead of DLCDC.
Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, I believe that what this does, and you'll have some technical experts who come up later, but I believe what this does is make it possible for local governments to, consistent with statewide land use planning rules and goals, move uphill when prudence dictates that growth uphill would be way more suitable and safe and cost effective than growth in the low-lying areas that are subject to tsunami. So it would make our rules even more sensible, if you can imagine.
I understand that, but what I wanted to do is get on the record to make sure that local government's making decisions, not DLCDC.
Yeah.
Because I believe that when it comes to planning, who knows it better than the people that live in the community, especially if they understand what the problem is.
Right. Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, my understanding is that this empowers local governments to make good decisions that they're currently not empowered to make.
Okay, fine. So. I'm good. I want to make
if
sure
you look
that's
in
the record.
Section 1, line 26 kind of sums that up so as well.
And we do have somebody signed to speak from
DLCDC.
So, yes.
Thank you.
Any other?
Hopefully they're here to testify in support.
They may be against it. Have you checked with them?
You may want to hang around, Representative. I don't know. But any other questions of these witnesses? Nope. Thank you very much for bringing the legislation. So why don't we hear from, we can hear from everybody, I guess. So Dave Stuckey, Patty
Snow.
Snow, and Jay Raskin. Why don't you all come up and we'll have this conversation. So, Mr. Stuckey, are you going to start us off? Or who?
I'm going to start with Jay, if that's
okay.
Fine with
you. Okay, very good. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record, Jay.
I'm Jay Raskin. I'm the vice chair of OSPAC, and I'm also a former city councilor and mayor of Cannon Beach, and have been working on Cascadia-related issues for about 20 years now. I'm representative, Chair Lively, and the committee. I wanted to actually give some examples about why this is really a necessary thing to do for the coastal communities. As it was stated before, this was really a recommendation that was generated out of the Oregon Resilience Plan, which OSPAC prepared, and which the Oregon Resilience Task Force then passed on as one of their major recommendations as well. One of the nice things about this bill that I really appreciate, that it directly relates back to the Oregon Resilience Plan, is the fact that it's involving planning, business development, and DOGAMI in a collaborative effort. And this has been one of the key findings of the Oregon Resilience Plan, which is that basically we need these collaborative approaches to become resilient. This is an example. This is a community called Minamu Sanrico in Japan. This is before the 2011 Tohoku earthquake. And this is what this community looked like afterwards. So the details are going to be different for Oregon communities, but essentially in all those tsunami inundation zone, this is the level of destruction that we can be expecting. As part of their recovery process, they basically have gone through this planning process, which this bill is essentially alluding to, and they basically have looked at what things need to be in an inundation zone and what can be moved to higher ground. And so they have a recovery plan, which they're doing after the fact. Really, what we're trying to do, I think what this bill really tries to do and is speaking to is, in this case, it's a recovery vision, and what we're trying to do, can we make this a resilience provision? What can we do beforehand to essentially make this recovery much easier, reduce the amount of cost, increase the safety? And this, I think, is something that I'm very pleased to support, and I'm here for any questions.
Thank you very much.
Hello. Hello, Chair Lively. I'm Patty Snow. I'm the Ocean and Coastal Program Services Division Manager with DLCD. We're actually officially neutral on this bill, but we did want to provide some testimony because we are obviously directly affected by it. I did want to address some of Representative Esquivel's comments. I meant to bring up, and I have with me actually a tsunami planning guide that our department developed over the last year or two, because actually in response to the Oregon Resilience Plan, because we realized that local governments needed planning assistance. And we looked all over, actually we hired a consultant, and we looked all over the world for planning guidance, and actually developed, I think, a really good guidance that we've actually started just currently working with. Clatsop County is the first county that's actually taking the recommendations of the tsunami land use planning guide, and they're going to be working to implement that into their plan. So we're really pleased about that. But just so you know, we have a coastal staff actually out in Newport, and they work really closely with local governments, Tillamook County, all the coastal jurisdictions. So we're talking with any jurisdiction that will listen to us about implementing the plans. And so it's very, very much something that we're very much want to work with local governments. Seaside is another example. As you may have heard, that all their schools are in the inundation zone. And so we were working with them to figure out innovative ways to move outside the urban growth boundary. They did identify a forested area right right outside, just adjacent to their urban growth boundary, but that we were very much supporting that they move their schools to. But unfortunately, the ballot measure that would have provided funding for that didn't pass, so they're still working, looking at different options. But I guess the point is that we know that local governments, especially communities like Seaside, where I believe it's about 90% of their buildings would be are in the inundation zone. And so we know we really want to very much be working with these communities. Rockaway Beach is another example. I do have some written testimony that I'll provide to your commission administrator, but basically, as you know, the bill directs our commission, LCDC, to enact rules establishing requirements for local government to plan and zone to minimize the impacts of tsunami inundation. Current state requirements that regulate permissible development within tsunami inundation zones are actually in ORS 455, which DOGAMI implements. And these use limitations are implemented through administration of the building code. And so the current bill in front of you would direct the establishment of rules requiring local government to implement land use and zoning measures addressing the tsunami hazards that would presumably be in addition to the existing statutory requirements. I guess the point that we want to make is that we really do want to work with local governments. We are currently working with them. We're a little concerned about rulemaking right now. We want to make sure that any rulemaking we do is appropriate for the local governments, because each agent is, as you know, each local government, Seaside is different than Coos Bay, is different than Bandon. They all have different situations, different hazard levels, and we want to make sure that the rules that we do adopt are flexible enough and appropriate for local governments. And so right now we are working with local governments, and so we're thinking that the rulemaking actually should probably be postponed, you know, maybe 12 to 18 months after we've had a chance to work with Clatsop County and other jurisdictions with our land use planning guide in terms of what works for them. I did want to mention that, as you probably know, this bill is quite similar to another bill that I believe is having a hearing right now, Senate Bill 94. I can't be in two places at two times either. But there certainly are several important differences. We thought this was the one thing that we thought was very important about this bill is that it included appropriations for local governments, because as many of your representatives have noted, without the local governments being able to change their plans, this won't work. So we very much support that, and we're very willing to very much want to work with local governments and the legislature and our fellow state agencies to get our coastal communities to be more resilient, and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, why don't we have Mr. Stuckey, then we'll ask questions.
All right, Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Stuckey, the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department and former Director of the Office of Emergency Management. During the Task Force Resiliency Days for this past year, I was a member of that committee, and this is a very, very important topic. We're very, very pleased with Representative Widener and the other sponsors for bringing this forward and discussing this land use concepts. This was one of the main topics that one of our city delegates for our task force was very high in discussing, Mayor Endicott, City of Redmond, and not only how do we do the land use planning before, but it's also after. And I would also like to encourage you to think about that if the city of Seaside is in fact 90% of it and inside the inundation zone, and that city is in effect, hypothetically speaking, is no longer in existence after a Cascadia subduction zone, what do we do then? How do we recover? And what kind of rules and authorities would we have to adopt to try and recover that city and that jurisdiction to help create that economic engine that we need in order to put the coast and the state back to business? And so I think there's a lot of goodness in both the front end as well as the back end in this, and the response as well as mitigation as well as the recovery component. As you know, the Resiliency Task Force did not look at it from a resource standpoint. We had some great recommendations, and Jay as well as Dr. Ashford earlier in this session provided those results, and this is a lift right out of one of those recommendations. There is a cost to the local governments. We're certainly concerned about making certain that they have some type of benefit there, but at the same time, this also covers best practices and comprehensive planning and some things that local governments have been encouraged and wanted to participate in the past. And so we believe that inundation zone mapping and incorporation of that is certainly something that of great concern and should be added to the mix. We just want to put that on record, and with that I'll close and see if there's any questions.
Okay, Okay. What questions? Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple things. One is, what's our time frame on this? That's right. And then the second thing is, if you had a 9.0 off the Oregon coast, do we know approximately how large of a tsunami we'd have? I mean, how high is that going to be?
The inundation, actually, Dogami has a series of maps where they've mapped various scenarios. So it depends a little bit on how big the event is going to be. So there's about five scenarios that they've mapped that's available for local planning purposes. So some of them, the smaller ones would be tsunamis that would come from a distant event. And then they have several that are basically cascading events that will range from what they call extra large and extra extra large. And so the mapping is, you can see from the mapping how what the worst case scenario is and what the best case scenario would be from a tsunami. So planning can take essentially these various scenarios into account.
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, the answer is we don't know. We don't know when it's going to occur and how big it is, but we need to
prep. Larger, extra large.
Yes, sir.
Right.
We need to plan. We need to plan the worst case scenario. Another recommendation of the Task Force Resiliency was the adoption of the L line and in creating a new large picture line in statute. And Dogami has a statute 455-446 that talks about the inundation line. And I think there's some funding concerns or constraints there also in trying to ensure that the new L line is adopted fully across the state, and it also has some impacts at the local government.
Mm-hmm. So I have a couple of questions regarding local governments and how long it takes. And so I appreciate we now have a lot more information regarding what the potential is, right, what the impacts were, and these communities have for years been putting forth plans to comply with state guidelines. And now we've determined that there's reasons why those guidelines, as communities have put them forth, don't necessarily work as well as we would hope they would because of the tsunami. So I'm trying to understand, so how long, so if we've designed those zones, they have current plans in place that in many cases now show growth going into areas where it probably shouldn't go into. So help me understand the scenario to get from here to there to change those plans, still comply with our guidelines, the state guidelines in that. So what's the time frame and that they'll get there? Because while I appreciate it may not be tomorrow the event, but I do know that some of these processes have been fairly difficult for local communities to get through, to get an adopted, approved plan so they can move forward. So can somebody help on that?
I might just jump in. And use the example of Seaside, because they're the ones who actually, in many ways, got the school district got the ball rolling in some of these issues. Comprehensive plan at this point wants you to keep more of a compact urban growth boundary. There were only a few exceptions for actually increasing the urban growth boundary. At the time that the school district was looking to expand, it was unclear whether a natural hazard like a tsunami and the Cascadia event was sufficient reasons for doing that. It now appears that it is, but it still leaves into question some of the goals for urban growth boundaries: compact, livability, sustainability, all these things. What's unclear for most local communities is how does that actually work if you're actually going to relocate your community or parts of your community outside of that, and that's really the key areas where we need guidance for how, you know, we understand what the reasonings are. Sure. We want to maintain the spirit of these things, but what are we doing when we essentially are relocating parts of communities? And that's the places where it's most difficult for local communities to figure out.
That's hopefully where this legislation will help. Go ahead,
Chair Lively and members of the committee. In terms of plan amendments, I mean, local governments can initiate plan amendments anytime, but it's certainly complex plan amendments, like moving your urban growth boundary, do take time. So I mean, that is something to consider, you know, months to you know, years, actually. But I think, you know, we are very sensitive. We know that to the fact that in some of these communities, like Seaside, for example, they really should not be building more in those inundated areas, the areas that would be inundated, you know, especially with the bridges that they have that will probably not be there after especially a level 9 tsunami, or excuse me, earthquake and tsunami. So We do realize that there's going to be reasons, hazard reasons, to expand urban growth boundaries. And we've also talked about the possibility of using urban reserves as an idea for some of these areas where communities could move out to. I know Coos Bay, actually, City of Coos Bay, their mayor talked with us about that because they realized that a fair amount of their downtown is also in the inundation zone. So they're starting to talk with us about, well, where should we be planning for our communities to move to? And I think we're more than willing to work with them to be creative using urban reserves, using exceptions, or whatever methods we need to use to get there.
The reason I ask that is down in Southern Oregon, we did the regional problem solving, and the 2-year project ended up to be 12 or 14 years. I can't remember what it ended up. So I'm concerned with time frame. We may not have 12 or 14 years.
The Oregon Resilience Plan tried to address this issue because we don't know when it's going to be, and it was for that reason we picked a 50-year time frame, in part because there was an example of the Chile who had a 50 years ago had a big earthquake and tsunami, and they were able to kind of make this adaptation in preparation for one that happened almost 50 years later, and we said, well, we're about the same size, and that seems reasonable. So I don't think this is something that has to happen right, immediately, but I think it's something that we have to start the process and keep at it. So I don't think we don't have a date fixed that we have to end this thing by. We might, but we don't know it. So we'll have to do the best we can.
Just to keep it in perspective, Chair Lively and Representative Esquivel, I think in the 09 and the 11 sessions, I don't think anyone was really talking much about Cascadia. We have a whole host of bills and discussions at this point in time. And so we're encouraged and just really excited on this side of the table to see that these types of actions and conversations and bills are occurring. We're not expecting results tomorrow either, but we agreed with the OSPAC approach of 50 years, but the more we can just peck at this issue and try and ensure that we raise these issues to a higher level to get everyone's sense and understanding and try and solve it, the better off we'll be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We talked about it on this, didn't we, John? We talked several sessions on this, but it really didn't hit home in the last couple of years. Then it kind of hit home.
It did.
And like, wow, we have a problem.
Sure.
So, I think we talked about it, but talk's cheap, takes money to buy whiskey. We weren't at the bar.
Okay. Others. The only thing I would add is, I commend the efforts. I think they all make great sense. I'm still concerned about how we get there, and especially this working with communities so we don't put them in position, because obviously they're still within this. Not everybody necessarily is going to agree that the best option is to move to the forest over here versus someplace else, even though we can understand all the reasons for that. And so I think it's just incumbent upon us to really work closely and understand what those challenges are in communities and find if there's other impediments in the way that they can get to that point, because we may have 50 years and we may not. But it's even if it's not the years, it's the cost to communities to keep this process going and going and going and dealing with those, the appeals and all that stuff, that sometimes is just as much of an impediment as the time itself. So, but I applaud the efforts. I think it's, we do. We have to start someplace and start working on it. So, anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3447?
Good bill should pass.
Okay. I close the hearing on House Bill 3447. I'm going to open a hearing on House Joint Memorial 18. Mr. Administrator, would you like to?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Joint Memorial 18 urges Congress to change the funding of veterans' health care from discretionary entitlement to permanent and direct entitlement. There's no fiscal or no revenue impact. There may have to be a fiscal impact. And before you on the dais, you have testimony from Mr. Mike Sullivan, for all the members.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you a HJM 18, which we've done several times, and we continually ask Congress to take the VA system and put it in dedicated funding instead of discretionary funding. The only way we're going to get a good handle on our VA system and some consistency in it is if we have consistency in the funding of it. And it can't be used, in my opinion, as a pawn at times, and it can't be used as an up and down thing of, well, we're short money this time. Well, if you're short money, that's going to hurt the veterans. So it needs to be consistent, and it needs to be tied to something that we can count on, and the VA system itself needs to have this clarity on where it's going for the future. I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director in Oregon for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly known as AWPPW. Before I begin my comments, I would like to thank the gentleman to my right, Representative Escobar. I've always sought out to sponsor this bill, and he usually always has, if I haven't been able to get somebody else. And, of course, his chief of staff and Jan. I kind of dropped the ball this time around. They picked it up for me. I would like to tell this committee a little history of what I know of the Veterans Committee in the House. I started working for AWPPW in 2005. And at that time, Representative Donna Nelson was the chair and my representative. And she tried over 156 bills. I'm sure Senator or Representative Esquivel and Representative Huffman might recall that. She had to pare it down from that 156 from the work done by then Representative Brian Boquist and Dave Hunt. But by 2011, the question had been asked of me from Senator Miles Anderson, have you heard anything back? And no, I hadn't. So I wrote a letter to the national commander of the Disabled American Veterans, and I've never to this day received any word from them, the federal government, or whatever. But back to Representative Nelson, she knew there was such a need for veterans because I asked the legislative librarian, Rob, to look up the exact date. It was, she thought, over 50 years. In 2005, it was 42 years since the Veterans Affairs Committee had met. So there was a terrible need. There were a lot of people that were left out, post-Korean War veterans and, quote-unquote, virtually the veterans of the Vietnam War. The mandated funding is important, like Representative Escobar said, because in order to set up their budget, they have to know how much they have for doctors, lawyers, nurses, technical people, and the like. And so it's pretty harum-scarum. The VA gets a lot of criticism, but there's reasons for why it's not as good as it could be. I submitted the letter that I wrote to Donnell Adams for you all to look at. In closing, considering the lack of response from the federal government or DAV or whoever, I would ask that you, Chair Lively, assuming that it passes out of this committee and goes to the House and is unanimously voted on as it has been five previous sessions, that you co-author a letter with your counterpart in the Senate, Senator Boquist, and have that letter go with the Secretary of State when she files the memorial. I want to again thank this committee for the years that I've come here and the fine work. And again, with Representative Nelson, as she said, there is no partisanship in this committee. The blood runs for all the veterans, and I would like to believe that all committees have that that task at hand. And so, thanks again, and if there's any questions, I'd be more than willing to try and answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Lively, committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Partners and Joiners America, Oregon Air National Guard, 1960 through 1964. You've heard from the experts why this bill is needed. It's too bad it's not a national law. I think we've all been embarrassed and ashamed at the news that's come out of the Veterans Association the last decade. If this was a national law, my opinion, our veterans would be in a lot better shape today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of these members? Okay, I have Mr. William Blake also wishes to testify.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, my name is William Blake. I am the Vice President of Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. We represent disabled vets and help make their lives better. I'm a Navy veteran, and what I can see in the future is the veteran community will grow exponentially because of the downsizing of our efforts overseas. And we've got a lot of homeless vets, we've got a lot of vets that are not, I'm getting taken care of pretty much well myself, but it takes a lot of time to get anything done. And if we can change the way they're funded, I think that it gives everybody a better chance to survive. There are people that aren't, the suicide rate for veterans is astounding. And so I appreciate the efforts of this committee and this legislation. And Chairman Lively, thank you very much, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Blake, for taking the time to testify. We appreciate it. Anybody else who wishes to offer testimony on House Joint Memorial 18? Okay, I'll close the public hearing. At this point, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3048. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3048 establishes the Resiliency Investment Fund in the State Treasury for the purposes of resiliency projects, directs the Office of Emergency Management to administer as specified, declares an emergency effective on passage. There may be a fiscal revenue impact statement, none have yet been issued, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Very good. Representative Evans, please.
This is a task force.
I heard the word already.
Could I say that out loud?
I think you volunteered. Representative Chair, members of the committee, for the record, this is a lot farther back than I remember. I'm Paul Evans, representative, representing House District 20, Independence, Monmouth, and West Salem. Of all the bills that I have asked for a hearing on, this one is truly to begin a conversation. The bill before you is nowhere near close, as I have several folks behind me that will attest to. But I want us to remember kind of the way things work in this building, especially as a freshman. You see a problem, there's a concept, there's a draft, there's a discussion, there's a redraft, there's another discussion, and there's another problem. The bottom line is, we pay, it's an expected standard, how this whole thing started, is that it's an expected standard that 1%, well, in many state buildings that are built, or many state contracts, there's 1% set aside for art. My theory was, well, if you can set 1% aside for art, why not set 2% aside for resiliency, with the idea of 1% of that 2%, so half, spent at least on something on site that could be helpful, and perhaps another 1% put into a fund that could be used as much like a wetlands bank in terms of seismic resiliency for projects that may need assistance. So goes the plan. Evidently, from good advice, you can't really spend money off-site, and there needed to be more clarity. So we're looking at several different amendments, one of which we thought would get close, but it's not probably going to be close enough. So again, this may end up being a work group or a task force, or maybe we'll change the name to a task group.
There, I like it.
but again, the concept is finding ways that make sure that when people are investing in these structures, we have a disconnect, I think, sometimes. And I learned this when I was working on local school bonds. We went
for $3 million to upgrade an old, unreinforced masonry building. Great idea, but the money we spent will save, it created a life space inside the structure, but it doesn't necessarily, we couldn't afford the amount of money to make sure that we could reinforce it in a way that would be able to stand afterwards and be useful afterwards. So the idea was, the difference between the 1%, if you're building a new building, it's going to have to be normal standards. But a lot of the normal standards today aren't necessarily focused on using the building afterwards. They're used on what we think is necessary to keep people alive. So what I plan on going back to the drawing board is trying to find a way, again, a 1% like art model, but having conversations with the different folks that need to be involved in that, and finding a way that when we build public buildings, we're not just going to the lowest baseline life safety piece, but perhaps a little bit up the chain. Because at the end of the day, after a significant catastrophic event, we're going to need some structures that are available. And public structures, because they are shared investments, seem to be a logical choice. So I really do appreciate the conversation to start this. I'm looking forward to the comments from the Treasurer's Office and others are going to come up and explain what may or may not be possible in the future. But I think to echo Colonel Stuckey's perspective, however we got here, we are starting to have a lot of the conversations we need to have across the board, and I'm hoping that this is one of those conversations that can continue in the interim. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them or tap dance quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. A couple things when I read the bill came to my mind. One is that I'm not sure that can we use that money for something other than the capital project itself.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what the bond folks said.
There you go.
I'm totally excited about that. Generosity.
And then The second thing is, you said we had 1% for art, but don't we have in place like 1% for green energy or something for new buildings? I think there's additional monies.
I think that's a good idea.
But I think it's in place.
Yeah.
Well, so that's 2%. So now we're 4%. So.
And again, I'm going to go down 1% more, just to 3%.
So if I heard your testimony correct, Mr. Representative Evans, you would prefer that we not vote right away, but we listen to their testimony first?
Yes, sir. That would be very nice.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks a lot. So we have three people signed up, Mr. Dave Tuckey, Laura Lodwood McCall, and Bruce Schreiber. Mr. Stuckey.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. I'm one. I have no idea who the other two are coming up here, but I just wanted to get on record that, you know, should this legislation move forward, the Resiliency Fund be created, we're committed to doing everything in our power to try and make this work. There's some goodness in this. There's clearly some complexity, as Representative Evans has outlined in this bill. As your good committee administrator mentioned up front, there might be a potential fiscal assigned to that, at least trying to manage that with some people, and so it takes some people money. You know, we certainly have a great grant called an EMPG grant where we can match it half to general fund on the other half, so we can buy more with 50% if we're to move forward with that. And so there's lots of different ways that we could try and help support this. But just basically in conclusion, we would certainly like to be a part of that discussion bill, and certainly see if we can get something moving down the road to help shed a light on this type of issue. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Any questions? Sound like we're all right so far.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yep. The task group is forming.
Okay.
It's two, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a task group.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. So how many task forces has Dave signed up for so far?
That's what I want to know. I think every time Paul has one, I think Dave's on him.
Yeah.
This is also on the list. A coordinated attack.
Thank you. Yes.
For the record, hello. My name is Laura Lockwood McCall, and I'm the director of the Debt Management Division in the Oregon State Treasury. I don't know if you, Bruce, you want to introduce yourself?
And for the record, my name is Bruce Schreiber. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you.
I've submitted some testimony today. Cynthia Burns, who's the bonded, the Department of Justice attorney who usually works on bond issues with me, couldn't be here today. But the three-page memo we're submitting is sort of a combination of a legal analysis and also some more practical suggestions from the Treasurer's Office. I'm sorry to, as Representative Evans has stated, to say that in its current form, Treasury would be pretty strongly opposed to this bill because we don't think it's workable. We absolutely support the concept of resilience and upgrading our building codes, but we think that there may be more straightforward ways than attaching percentages to specific bonds. In fact, having in a previous lifetime, I was in charge of facilities as well as finance in California, and I think 1% is too little. And so I'm not quite sure that 1% gets you the kind of improvements that the Representative Evans suggested. So I could go into great depth about all the legal issues, but as Representative Esquivel has noticed, we have a constitution that carves out specific purposes, and you can only spend bond proceeds on those purposes. So the 1% that would just go into a pot that could be used this way and that would not really be able to be used this way and that. It would have to be used, if we did energy loans, it would have to be used for the energy loan program. If we did veterans loans, which is Bruce's area, we'd have to use it for that. It was sort of a broad scattered shot. And so that probably would take away the value of having a pot of money. As far as the 1% per project, I guess this is a little editorial. I think that making every project have a 1% is not the best use of the state's resource. Bonding is expensive. I think a more focused approach in picking the right buildings that are the most important buildings for resiliency, whether that be on the coast or in other parts of the state, is going to yield us better results. Again, it could be much more than 1%, but as currently written, the bill makes you put 1% to everything. And we just think that that's probably going to result in nice, really tight lighting systems. But what we need to do in Eastern Oregon may be really different than what we need on the coast. So in essence, at the end of reading all this legal analysis, our recommendation, perhaps task force notwithstanding, because we're more than happy to participate, is to look at the state's building codes and to really look at the public facility standards for both state and local facilities and make cost-benefit decisions, because I think, from my experience in California, that going from life safety to this higher resiliency standard will cost quite a bit. And there may be places where it's absolutely essential in terms of having a statewide emergency preparedness plan. And maybe in other places, well, maybe it's not the most valuable use of our limited resource. So I think I'll stop there and turn to Bruce.
Okay. Thank you, Laura. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Laura and I had not talked prior to walking into this committee hearing, so you're not getting double-teamed. But when I saw this bill, we just wanted to offer some considerations on your part. If this was meant to cover the types of bonds that we issue, which are bonds to get funds to lend to veterans, you're going to have a constitutional conflict.
It wasn't.
What's that?
It wasn't. It was for new capital construction for schools and things like that.
But in the text, it does talk about Article 11A.
I'm not legislative counsel.
Bit of ambiguity there. So anyway, if it was to cover, meant to cover veteran bonds, you'd have a constitutional conflict. The proceeds have to go to the Oregon War Veterans Fund. It couldn't go to this resiliency fund. The proceeds have to be lent. I would assume the monies in this fund would be to use for grants, and you know. So I mean, there's a couple things that might be problematic, and so with that, I'll just stop.
That one I knew about.
That one.
So ultimately, Laura, if we were put together a plan that shows the needs to make investments in key buildings, we could bond for those specific investments to reach some of
through
these
the
goals.
Chair, absolutely. Yeah. We have a variety of techniques, whether it was the Article Q bonds for state facilities, but it would be cooked into the project itself.
Yeah.
And then even if the legislature chooses to start funding projects for schools, which I think looks like it's got a pretty good chance, that could be built into the building standards and the rules of the grant. Okay. So I think there's other ways where you don't end up spending $350 an hour having bond attorneys having to look under the covers of every single project, but rather sort of build it more, cook it into, if you will, into the daily operations of folks in the state who are responsible for facilities.
Sure. Any other questions? Representative Esco.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to see us get to the point where, you know, we have a 60-some billion-dollar biennium budget. That's 60-some billion-dollar biennium budget. If you could just save $20 million a biennium, well, you know, pretty soon you'd have some real money in there. But we don't seem to, I don't think we save very much at all in this state. And I think we need to start disciplining ourselves and looking at especially programs throughout the whole state itself to see how effective they are and start cutting those back and putting money in for these types of scenarios. Because when this thing hits us, it's going to be very, very costly to this state. And we're not preparing for it, and we need to prepare for it. And I'm glad you brought this up, Representative.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you both for coming to testify. Sure. Anybody else who wishes to offer testimony on House Bill 3048? Please state your name and your state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Levett, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers, OACFO. I would just say ditto to what you heard from the Treasurer's Office, and at the risk of volunteering one of our members to participate in the task force, we'll help too.
So,
that's right. So, I think you've got enough members, Representative Evans. Any questions for the question?
Got a big task group.
Yeah. Thank you very much. For anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
Chair, Lively, members of the committee, at the risk of piling on, Wendy Johnson from the League of Oregon Cities. We saw the bill and we're equally concerned with what the ramifications were. We saw the benefits of some of this funding, but we're concerned with the bond issues. Originally, when I read the bill, I thought that it was applying to local government bonds as well, but the first section says it applies to 286A, which would be only the state bonds issues. But we agree that the issue needs to be dealt with, and it's a creative idea.
Very good. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Good job, Representative Evans, of bringing up the testimony.
Chair.
Yes, sir. Thanks.
Got them together.
Representative Huffman, please.
I think the great success here today is that Representative Evans showed us how to build a successful task force. You come in with a bill that scares the hell out of everybody, and they volunteer just line
to
up.
Be part of it.
That was amazing. I applaud you.
Good job. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3048. But it was a successful hearing. Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3463. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3463 authorizes the issuance of Article 11Q bonds for the Oregon Military Department headquarters, establishes the Oregon Military Department headquarters facility fund in the state treasury, direct state treasurer to deposit the $5 million in net proceeds and interest earnings of bonds into the fund, directs the military department to administer as specified, declares an emergency effective 1 July 2015. Fiscal and revenue impact statements have not yet been issued, but there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. And so, Representative Evans, is there anything you want to disclose up front before you start your testimony? Or?
Chair Lively, as a matter of fact, yes, actually, there is.
Okay.
If the last bill was broad, this bill is right on target.
Okay.
Specific. I'm not sure that, for the record, I'm still Paul Evans, House District 20. This bill was brought to me during a time of transition at the military department and also what turned out to be transition at DAS. And the bottom line is this. Wanting to make sure that there's a vehicle to provide the option for a match requirement that's going through the military DOD budget process for an upgrade of the military department. I'm sure Deputy Director Stuckey and others are going to come forward and explain whether it's needed or not, but it was a placeholder vehicle to make sure that we didn't lose out on money set aside by DOD for that particular project. It took about 4 years to get. So that's the purpose of the bill. It may or may not be needed. It's up to the department, but it was offered to make sure that we didn't lose out on that money.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Stuckey.
I'm going to sit here while you're talking. Can I sit next to you, sir? Yes, you can.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Dave Secchi, Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. Certainly, we have two main issues with our current Joint Force Headquarters building, the Copper Top building where the Oregon Military Department is housed. It's at max capacity for staffing, and it's also structurally not capable of withstanding a Cascadia. So it takes several years on the federal side, the National Guard Bureau side, in order to get something on a construction type of plan. And we have that for a new building. And the project will be about $18.5 million on the federal side. And technically, we need 6.7 in bonding authority on the state side in order to match that. And our plan was to put this right next to the Anderson Readiness Center. And outside of wherever the governor's standing and wherever you all convene, we think the Anderson Readiness Center and that campus is probably one of the most important places in state government in terms of response. That building and that structure has OSP in it. It has the National Guard jock. It has one of ODOT's best AOCs, and it has OEM's ECC. And so the plan was to put the new Joint Forces Headquarters building behind the Anderson Readiness Center. And so basically create this complex of safety response type actions for state government. And so unfortunately, there was some issues in how that land was viewed during the agency request budget time period, as well as the governor's recommended budget, and so it didn't make the GRB, and so we would be happy to work with the LFO and the Capital Construction Sub if we got a referral to this project, and so with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stuckey. And I think that if we do the Signy Die video, you're going to win the slot for the most acronyms in one sentence.
Oh, sorry.
Just kidding. No, and I wanted to thank you and say that. I'm sure that, and I apologize for being gone for so long. I was in the Senate Vets Committee testifying on two bills that will be coming over here soon. And at the very last, there were a lot of questions that we committed you to a lot of stuff, you know, since you weren't there. OEM got, and they said if Dave Stuckey were here, he would be answering these questions for us. But he couldn't be in two places at once. But it's all good work, and it shows how busy things are now, and that we'll be seeing all those things coming over here next. So thanks.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're talking about $6.7 million, did you say, instead of $5 million?
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, yes, in bonding.
Okay.
For $18.5 million on the federal side. And that would be for federal fiscal year 16, so it is the next biennium.
Okay.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Escobar, if I could provide a little context that Deputy Director Stuckey can't say. There was a conversation with somebody who used to run DAS but no longer does, that this would be taken care of. And in the absence of that person to actually make that happen, because he no longer works there, that's one of the reasons I was pushing to make sure that it gets, the department has been doing what it was told to do, and I want to make sure we don't lose that capability. So, and it got rounded up a little bit because of that conversation. So just, it would be needed to be amended.
Follow up. Okay, now we're going to build a building in back of our existing building. Is that correct?
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, yes. It'd be a campus-like setting there around the
Anderson. What's the capacity of that?
There is suitable land for this building structure, Representative Escobar.
I'm not worried about the land, but what's the capacity for manning, for personnel? Because I don't want to build something and then 10 years later we're back here saying, you know, we need to add on to the campus.
Yeah, Chair Lively, Representative Escobar, this new building structure that was approved from a planning standpoint, also at the National Guard Bureau level, is an augmentation to the existing building. So what we're taking is the command group and several significant staff positions out of the existing Oregon Military Department building and moving it over into this new seismically capable or essential building code capacity, and that's the response that we'd have, and we wouldn't anticipate coming back here 10 years from now for a third building.
I won't be here, trust me.
Chair Lively, Representative Escobar. We have long-term planning goals that we could certainly talk about if you would like to in this discussion.
Just put that on a task group.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll shut up.
Representative Bowman.
Other questions? So, just help me understand this. So where are we at? The federal money is approved and available in 2016.
Yes, Chair Lively.
The state money, regardless of where it's coming from, is not in, or not in the budget, not somewhere. I'm just, I lost something here, sorry.
Chair Lively, it was not in the GRB.
Yeah.
But the co-chairs know that this budget knows that this needs to be an add-on.
Okay.
So that conversation has happened.
Yeah. Okay.
Chair Lively, it was briefed in our phase one testimony. And the first phase two for public safety sub is tomorrow, and I'll be there at 1 o'clock.
Okay, great. Go ahead, Representative.
So we'll punt this on down. Same thing happened to me in 2011 on the Dallas Readiness Center. We had been working for years on the federal appropriation, and one day Greg Walden calls me out in the hall and says, we got the money. And so I had to scramble, although it was May, so it was a month later than we are here, where we had to scramble to get 4.3 or something like that million that had not, it was known about like this, but had not been planned on currently. So,
okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you, both of you. Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3463? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3463. Now, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2839. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you recall, House Bill 2839 allows an employer to claim a tax credit for employing a qualified military veteran as specified. Applies to the tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2015 and before January 1, 2021. It takes effect on the 91st day following the adjournment of sine die. The committee last heard the measure on March 5th. Revenue and fiscal statements light have been issued for the purposes of moving the measure on to the House Committee on Revenue.
Okay.
Chair Lively, I would move House Bill 2839 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2839 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrott?
Aye.
Representative
Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye.
Motion passes. Okay, so I'll open a work session on House Bill 2840. Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2840 establishes the Oregon Education Workforce Development Bridge Loan Program in the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs as specified. The committee again heard the measure on March 17th. Again, fiscal and revenue statements have been issued for the purpose of moving the bill onto the House Committee on Revenue, and there is a proposed Dash 1 amendment before you which clarifies the language of the bill.
Okay. Do you want to say something about the amendment?
Yes, sir, if I could.
Yes.
I don't know which mic to use. Dash one really is making sure that the program is even more expansive in terms of who it can help. Bottom line, we just want to make sure that apprenticeships were included as well. And that's the language.
Okay. Any other discussion of the amendment? Hearing objection to the amendment? Okay, if not, the amendment's included. Can I do that, or do you have to move the amendment?
Actually, I have to move the amendment.
Okay, sorry.
So, take that. Chair Lively.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Chair Lively, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-18-15.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-18-15. Is there any discussion? No, is there any objection? Okay, then.
Now
the amendments adopted.
Chair Lively, I moved House Bill 2840 as amended to the floor with the adopted recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2840 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion carries. Now, I'll open a work session on House Bill 3029.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3029 creates the subtraction from taxable federal survivor benefits, directs the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and Department of Revenue to administer. The committee last heard the bill on March 12th. Again, a revenue and fiscal statement have been issued for the purposes of moving the bill on to the House Committee on Revenue.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 3029 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 3029 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye.
Motion carries. Any other business to come before the committee? Oh. Hearing none?
Oh my gosh.
We're adjourned.
Wow.
You've been over there doing